disperse immediately or you will be subject to arrest with now.
A boss ain't nothing but a thief on a time loan. 128 bit war, you play Nintendo on some shooter, so put the bridge down and feed us to the killer bees. We get what we deserve, life. Bury me with my MP3s. Write my manifesto in 72 DPI. Life's just a game, you got cheated, never learn. I write these songs every bridge that ain't been burned. For every cop car that ain't.
Welcome to This Is America, June 2nd, 2018. On Saturday, June 30th, across the U.S., hundreds of thousands of people took to the streets against the Trump administration's attack on immigrants, with demonstrations, protests, and marches taking place in over 700 locations. Spurred on by the growing Occupy ICE movement and increasing anger at Trump, deportations, and mass raids, the rallies, much like the Women's March and March for Our Lives, were also largely organized by sections of the left tied to the Democratic Party. Unsurprisingly, instead of pushing the hundreds of thousands in the streets to join the small but growing occupations, left leadership, as exemplified by speeches by celebrities, union bureaucrats, local politicians, and nonprofit leaders, instead encouraged people to simply vote in November. Across the U.S., we here at IGD heard a variety of horror stories of DNC-aligned nonprofits and activists either threatening to snitch on anarchists, anti-authoritarians, and autonomous, or trying to actively stop people from occupying space in front of ICE buildings. Despite this treachery of so-called left leadership, occupations still kicked off this weekend, and on Monday, existing encampments were refortified. Here's a rundown and an update on exactly what's been going down. In Portland, Oregon, the encampment continues as ICE and DHS agents have busied themselves in refortifying their building with metal fencing and continue to block the street in front of the building. Meanwhile, outside, the occupation continues unabated, with those involved in the encampment currently asking for a steady stream of supplies, flags, and other items. In Tacoma, Washington, the occupation outside the Northwest Detention Center has started up again with a large rally on July 1st. Currently, daily noise demonstrations are happening at 9 a.m. and 9 p.m. Police and city officials have continued to wage a campaign of harassment against the encampment, but people continue to gather on site and hold assemblies and meetings. Supplies and people are still needed. In San Francisco, California, on July 2nd, hundreds rallied outside of an ICE facility, blocking the exits and entrances. After the main rally ended, an encampment began and at first faced heavily police harassment. Currently, the encampment is ongoing, but numbers and supplies are needed on the ground, and organizers are calling for bodies on the ground as early as 4:30 a.m. on Tuesday. In Richmond, California, hundreds of people rallied for several hours outside of a jail that also holds migrant detainees on July 30th. Although there were announced plans for an occupation, one never materialized after police told protesters that if they camped out, people would not be allowed to visit their loved ones on the inside. According to some posts online, this was simply a bluff by police to get them to leave. In Los Angeles, California, the occupation continued, as did blockades of various entrances, along with workshops and ongoing discussions. In San Diego, California, mass marches and rallies took place in Chicano Park and other parts of the city. On July 2nd, blockades also took place at the Federal Building. In Troy, Illinois, people blocked the freeway during a protest march. In Chicago, Illinois, a mass march took place against ICE and a brief occupation was attempted outside of an ICE facility. However, due to a variety of forces which quickly moved against it, it shut down the occupation after only a short time. In Carbondale, Illinois, people blockaded a Greyhound bus. Greyhound is a corporation that contracts with ICE. While this action may appear small, it also shows a concrete material contribution to the struggle that expands it beyond the encampments and shows a set of actions that others can easily reproduce. In Louisville, Kentucky, a coalition of groups has started an encampment outside of an ICE facility and faced already a raid by DHS officials. However, the occupation continues. We're now going to play our interview with somebody on the ground in Louisville. Okay, we're joined on the phone with an organizer out in Louisville, Kentucky. Do you just want to introduce yourself and tell us what group you're with?
Sure. My name is Jesus Ibanez. I am with Mi Gente Louisville. We're a Latinx organization.
Right, part of the Chinga La Migra tour, right?
Yeah, exactly. That's correct. Hell yeah.
Awesome. Just take us through the motions. What have you seen on the streets of Louisville? How did this encampment come to be, and where are people outside of exactly?
Sure. So this movement really began because the mayor here in Louisville has declared the city a compassionate city, which really is compassion in name only. We've been advocating for sanctuary city, which offers more concrete policies to protect not just immigrants, but undocumented immigrants. Well, the mayor's inaction led to local law enforcement collaborating with immigration and customs enforcement, collaborate with them on raids that destroy families, that separate families. So, you know, with this national momentum going on, there was a lot of people taking a look what was going on locally. There's people that have been doing this work for a long time, but, you know, at the mainstream level, a lot of people were upset, not just in the Commonwealth of Kentucky, but across the nation, as we've seen with the other occupied movements happening in New York, Detroit, and the Pacific Northwest. So we put a call to action this past Saturday. We overtook the rally that was organized by MoveOn.org, and we split the rally. There was probably maybe 1,300 people, and we got maybe 1,000 people from them. And we told them, we marched them from City Hall to the ICE office and told them, within 48 hours, we're going to pull up. Call to action. It's not just going to be rallies, but it's time to do something. And this is a call to action. We are saying that the time to abolish ICE is now. So we've been planning this for a little over a week now, in solidarity, not just with the Occupy ICE movements, but also with Mi Gente, because we are an offshoot of Mi Gente National, Mi Gente Louisville. So with their Save Free Our Future campaign, which began last week at the largest family detention center in the country in Tornillo, Texas, where 9 people got arrested for blocking the entrance to the detention center. So that was their kickoff. And today was the second action of the campaign, where 40,000 people converged to San Diego to do a mass civil disobedience. And we saw in solidarity with Mi Gente as well. So we've been planning with local grassroots organizations, Black Lives Matter, Stand Up Sunday, DSA, members of the ARA. So it's really grassroots led and not grass tops. So, and that's what we want, you know, local leadership that's been doing this work to be part of this movement. So we left, we've been collecting supplies, logistics, strategies for, like I said, about a week now. And this morning we've been up since 4 a.m. Eastern time. Some of us, you know, even longer than that, have 45 minutes to sleep. We barricaded here the layout of the ICE offices. We are in front of the ICE offices. We barricaded two of the gates, the front and the back entrance. We put a three-story banner that says Sanctuary for All, and another one that said Abolish ICE in front of the gate. Barricaded with a lot of heavy metal, and we set up about 15 to 20 tents directly in front of the entrance of the ICE building. This was around 6 in the morning. About 6:30, between 3 and 4, Department of Homeland Security officials came to tell us that we were on federal property, and we had until 7:30 to clear out, or they would clear us out. And we told them to, we just ignored them. They asked for the leadership. Well, we told them there is no leadership, we're a decentralized group. So when 7:30 came around, sure enough, true to their word, they dismantled our tent city. They destroyed our medical tent that we had set up, and they put it in the corner. They were very aggressive. They threw a pallet on top of the tents and destroyed the tents. We had some toys laid out in front of the driveway, which of course symbolizes the children and the families that are being separated. A federal van came out and ran over the toys. A young mother came with her children who were playing with the toys even after they got ran over by the vehicle. Then somebody who works maintenance along with DHS officials came out and started sweeping aggressively the toys while one of the kids was playing with them. So these are the type of tactics that they're using. So when they were cleaning the tents, I should specify that local law enforcement also joined them, which is in violation of the separation of power ordinance that was passed on October 26th of 2017, which clarified the duties of local law enforcement and federal authorities. And that all started because, like I said earlier, LMPD was collaborating with ICE on raids. So the mayor has been saying there is no collaboration, when in fact today we did see half a dozen vehicles initially with about six patrolmen intimidating us, standing behind us as DHS and ICE destroyed our tent city. A little while later, about a dozen patrolmen in their bicycles pulled up about 50 feet from where we are across the street and set up their own tent and their own canopy just to keep an eye out on us. So that's the situation. And also, we were told because we were on federal property, we could only take up a certain amount of space. And that's why we were kicked out of the grass area. So now we are standing directly in front of the building still. We have 1, 2, 3 canopies set up, many tables. Currently, there's a meeting going on. There's, I count about 30 to 40 people in attendance right now. So it's definitely growing. In the morning, we had about 15 to 20. I think at the height, we reached maybe close to 100 people. It was the hottest day of the year. It reached about 103 degrees, but people were still coming out supporting us with supplies, from food to clothing to shelter, which include tents and canopies. So it's a wonderful effort. It's great to see the community here, but the local law enforcement has been on the guard. The mayor came out and made an announcement in regards to this. They're calling it a protest. We've been saying abolish ICE, abolish ICE. The mayor came out and said that it's time to reform ICE. He said so many words, yet said so little. It was a baseless statement. Of course, he invoked DACA and the Dreamers, which just plays into respectability politics. There is no time, there is no space for respectability politics in the work of liberation, which is what we're doing. Because we are fighting for human rights.
You know, I think a lot of people that have been around social movements a while, this time period kind of harkens back to May of 2006, when we saw massive wildcat strikes and student walkouts. When do you think we're going to start seeing students start taking action and walking out? Because that would be something that could really aid the struggle, I feel like, right now.
Absolutely, and I look back at the students after the Florida shooting, you know, the Parkland students and the movement they've built, you know, and it's our youth and the students who are you know, demonstrating, who are practicing civil disobedience. So, yeah, I'm hoping that it's only a matter of time before the youth come out and support. But even within the immigrants' rights movement, there is this internal struggle. You know, there is one camp that believes in the dream of immigration reform, and then there's the other camp that believes that the dream of immigration reform is dead, and now we dismantle the deportation machine, which I am part of that camp.
How do you see that? Because it seems like a lot of people right now are just excited, or they're pointing to different Democrats, you know, kind of picking up this language. I mean, much like after Occupy, you started to see people, even Obama, use terms like the 99%. I mean, right. To us, that just means that, I mean, just because power kind of, you know, recuperates some of your language doesn't mean that you have a friend, you know, within, you know, the power structure. Like, what do you think it would actually mean to continue to build this material force towards the abolition of ICE, and also just the destruction of all these imposed borders and states?
Absolutely. I think it's really going to take a collective effort to hold these people accountable, because you're absolutely right. Politicians and other people, you know, they adopt, you know, the words, the language, but really they don't adopt the policies. You know, they just pay lip service. So it's either, you know, we're going to do this with politicians, which some people don't really want to do this with politicians, or we're going to find a way outside of the state to do it. Mm-hmm. You know, so it's either, you know, you're going to be with the state or against the state or within the state. You know, and some people are saying that we must form our own stuff, you know, independent of the state. You know, if the state, if the system is broken, you know, make a new system.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, I mean, how do you see things evolving from here? I mean, because obviously the police are going to, you know, try to keep coming down. I mean, like just this past weekend, we saw, you know, pretty brutal repression of an attempted encampment in Atlanta. I know that you all have set up your thing. There's people in Charlotte, North Carolina. People in San Francisco just set up an encampment today outside of an ICE facility. There's a big, massive demonstration. So, I mean, this thing isn't ending anytime soon, but you know, obviously the police and DHS want it to go away very quickly. I mean, how do you see things evolving in a positive direction for the movement?
Yeah, absolutely. I think there must be, you know, a bit more collaboration between these Occupy ICE movements. Because as of now, it's just, you know, independent movements. So if there was, you know, a strong national cohesive movement of, you know, Occupy ICE, you know, and more than sprouting out, it's you know, the numbers. It's going to be a numbers game. So, you know, the more people involved in this, you know, it's going to be more difficult for people to squash and to kill. So that is definitely the goal, getting people involved. So I do envision large-scale civil disobedience throughout the country. Right now, it's just, you know, about a dozen cities or so.
You know, we had on the program Mauro Villalpando, talking like right when the kind of controversies first started to erupt about child separation at the border. And one of the things that she brought up is like, look, like they're separating people all the time. Like, let's not just get caught up on this one, you know, thing that goes viral that shocks everyone or shocks white people. You know, like, we've got to look at this whole thing and how brutal it is. And I'm just curious if you had any comments on just, you know, this entire system of deportation and separating people that's also making massive amounts of money off of having people work in the fields and be afraid to be deported, and then also putting them in these private run facilities as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's, you know, Southwest Keys is one of those people who are profiting from this tragedy. But going back to the question that, you know, it's absolutely true. The separation and destruction of families is not something that just occurred in 2018. It's been going on for decades. It's been going on for centuries. So, you know, it's absolutely right that deportation is not just occurring at the border, but it's occurring in the interior of the United States. Families are not just being separated in Texas and California, but families are also being separated in Michigan, in Kentucky, in Tennessee, in North Dakota. This is going on throughout all 50 states. So it's you know, it's not that we shouldn't pay attention to this small issue, but we should be cognizant of a much larger problem,
right?
You know, of the systems of oppression, of white supremacy, of power dynamics. We should be very cognizant of that.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for joining us. Anything else you want to say, or anything else you want to touch on?
I just want to say that, remind people that, you know, the immigration issue is not really an immigration issue, but it's a human rights issue.
In Wichita, Kansas, an encampment outside an ICE facility kicked off on July 1st and continues to grow. In Charlotte, North Carolina, an encampment has been started after kickoff rally on July 1st. Follow the Carolina Workers Collective for more updates. In Atlanta, Georgia, an occupation was set up on June 30th, and over the period of several days, several clashes with law enforcement broke out. While the encampment was evicted on July 2nd, the determination and ability of the crowd to repel the very aggressive and weaponized police force was very inspiring. On the second day of the occupation, saw people playing a song that someone locked up in the ICE facility had requested. That night, a noise demonstration was also organized, with police chanting, "Todos somos antifascistas." Scuffles with the police also broke out, with police taking water and a tent shelter. However, people repelled the police and held their ground. Towards the end of the third day, police returned again to the encampment, this time with an army of bike cops, and finally were successful in shutting down the encampment, but in the process sexually assaulted and attacked numerous people. All Out ATL has produced a video report back, which you can see in our show notes, for scenes of strength and determination on the streets of Atlanta. In Washington, D.C., a mass demonstration against ICE saw a breakaway march from the abolitionist bloc rally outside of the condo owned by Stephen Miller, one of the archetypes of the Muslim ban and the zero-tolerance policy. In Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, a mass march was followed by the occupation and encampment of an area outside of an ICE facility. For several hours, a block party atmosphere existed on the ground, as banners blocked streets and a van blasted music. People then set to blockading the doors and entrances to the ICE facility and were soon met by police, DHS agents, and counterterrorism teams. Currently, federal law enforcement agents are threatening to arrest people in the morning if they do not clear the encampment. For more information on the Philadelphia encampment, listen to our short interview here with people on the ground.
Okay, right now we're talking to somebody in Philadelphia that's outside of the occupation that's happening. Do you want to introduce yourself real quick?
Yeah, my name is Noodle. I'm a representative from Liberation Project in Philly. We're like a leftist group that just organizes different things here.
Cool. So just take us to the beginning of what happened today. Was there a march that kicked this off? How did what we're seeing right now, which is pretty impressive, come into being?
So it started with a rally. There have been, I think, three rallies around ICE's awfulness, especially in Philadelphia, over the past couple of days. So it kind of kicked off last week that there was a group of older people that decided to occupy the ICE building to not allow them into work. I forget which day it was, I think Thursday morning. And then there was another rally on Saturday on the 30th. And then a coalition of, I think, 12 different organizations organized a rally today that eventually led into a march to the ICE offices. And then we've just been camping out there since.
So what's been going on since... Because we saw today from Unicorn Riot, I mean, there were beautiful banners that were put up. It was like kind of like a block party atmosphere. There was a van that pulled up that was blasting music. Can you just kind of describe the scene for people?
Yeah, it's been really great. There's just been like a lot of solidarity shown from a bunch of different people. People who can't participate in an actual camp out have been dropping off a lot of different supplies, just like 20 minutes ago, a car randomly pulled up with a bunch of coffee for us and like some sandwiches from Dunkin' Donuts. So overall, it's been really fun. The van was a guy that ended up being in the march, not realizing it was turning into an occupation. And he just happened to have a car parked nearby that had amps in it. So we were able to have a dance party for a couple of hours in the street. So we had the streets taken for, I think, probably about, what, like 6 hours? Like 3 or 4 hours. And the police moved in a couple of hours ago, and they told us that if we didn't take the tents down and get our blockades out of the street, then we'd be arrested immediately. So now everyone is camping out on tarps and yoga mats in front of the building.
Yeah, how else did the police respond? Because we're seeing on Unicorn Riot, they have a variety of different, you know, anti-terrorism units and stuff like that out. How are they responding to what's going on?
It's been interesting. They haven't really come close to it. There was like a weird thing that happened earlier that some like police woman that I think was just with the PPD, which is Philly's police unit, like tried to run at a protester who was just standing there, a legal observer that was just standing there, and tripped on the curb and had to be taken to the hospital. So she injured herself. But other than that, there have been no injuries on our side or their side, as far as I know. Other than that, Philly has like a special tactics unit specifically for like leftist protesting. They've been out. They haven't really done much other than observe. That's usually all they do. Philly really utilizes police cops. So they've had a lot of police cops or bike cops like lining up around the area And there's still a bunch of them around, but not close to us right now. And then they also had Department of Homeland Security out. And they were probably, like, the most uniformed up with, like, the helmets and batons and a bunch of, like, the plastic... Sorry, I'm, like, tired from being outside all day. Yeah, they have, like, the plastic handcuffs and stuff, but haven't utilized them.
So would you say that the DHS agents are playing more of an active role, at least in, like, you know, classical policing? Like, we're going to get you, we're going to put you in handcuffs than the regular police are? Or is it the same?
They seem to be working together. Like, they haven't been leaving from our eyesight when they have, like, their powwows, like, talking to each other. So they just seem to be working as one unit, although, like, they move separately. So, like, earlier we saw that the bike cops lined up, and then the counterterrorism people moved in behind them. And that was, like, in order to protect a garbage truck driving down the street. So it's been, like, kind of bizarre, like, what they're doing. At this point, we think that they're just moving every so often in order to scare us so that we don't sleep all night. But we're not really taking the bait, and a lot of people are taking naps right now.
Mm-hmm. What are people on the ground that are involved in the occupation or the encampment, what are they saying in terms of what they need for support?
Definitely more people. That's always needed. Water, food. If you want to donate money, our Venmo is at OccupyICePHL. That would be great.
Mm-hmm. What do you, what does tomorrow hold for the encampment, do you think?
So what we heard from one of our legal observers that talked to the cops was that if we took down the tents for the night, the police wouldn't move in on us tonight. However, when the ICE office wants to open up in the morning, they're going to have the feds take care of us in the morning. So we're kind of just preparing for that right now.
Mm-hmm. And is the encampment actually blocking the entrance to the ICE facility?
We have all of the garage doors blocked right now, and I believe we still have the front door. Yeah, we do. We have the front door as well. So there's like a fire escape exit that's still open, but that's only accessible from the garage, and we're blocking that.
Interesting. Anything else you want to report on what's going on? It seems like a very eventful day in Philadelphia.
Yeah, if anyone can bring more bodies out, that'd be great. Overall, it's like a really nice atmosphere. I want to thank like Portland and all the other cities that started this movement, because I don't think we would have been able to do this without y'all. So thanks.
In New York, New York, the encampment at Foley Square continues. On June 30th, the park was filled with people during the mass march that took place. Over the last 2 days, despite ongoing police harassment, the occupation has continued with daily programming, workshops, and events. In Montreal, the far right has been on a roll recently with a series of anti-migrant and anti-Islam demonstrations, pushing to build a large far-right big tent that includes open neo-Nazis and white nationalists. Despite the recent doxing of a variety of movement leaders which exposed the various connections between the anti-immigrant far-right and the outright neo-Nazis, the far-right has continued to push forward, hoping along with its counterparts in the US to recreate the same riotous fascist street movement in the UK that saw riots pop off in support of Tommy Robinson. On July 1st, a variety of far-right groups converged in Montreal on what they hoped would be their biggest demo yet, but turned out to be a disappointing failure that ended in them not being able to march and returning to find their buses smashed up, and also the loss of one of their membership list, which fell into the hands of anti-fascists. Wanting to know more about what went down, we're going to play an interview we conducted with long-term anarchist and anti-border activist Jaggi Singh.
Okay, you want to introduce yourself real quick and just tell us what happened this weekend in Montreal?
Sure. My name is Jaggi. I'm an anti-racist, anti-fascist, open borders organizer and activist based here in Montreal. And this July 1st, which is a holiday here in Canada and also in Quebec, a group called La Meute, which means wolf pack in English, was trying to demonstrate against what they call illegal immigration. La Meute, or the Wolfpack, is the largest far-right organization in Quebec. They have an online presence of thousands of members, which isn't too difficult, but they've managed over the past couple of years to bring out several hundred people to demonstrations against Islam and against immigration. They try to distance themselves from overt racists, but try to downplay the fact that they're overtly racist and try to focus on what they call radical Islam or illegal immigration. But in reality, they have a strong allyship with racist far-right groups. For example, their head of English recruitment for a while was a guy by the name of Sean Bovey McDonald, an open and unrepentant neo-Nazi who posted the 14 words on his Facebook profile, was in Charlottesville, and was an active member of the Montreal Storm chats, which were recently revealed and were able to reveal some key neo-Nazis based in Montreal and in Canada in general. This demonstration was done in alliance with a group called the Storm Alliance, which is another far-right group, and also a new group with the weird name Independence Day, which combines the Canadian and Quebec flags with the Statue of Liberty and misspells the word independence. It's weird, but the reason I mentioned the fact that they allied with this group called Independence Day is because the head of that group is the former head of the Quebec Ku Klux Klan. So while Lemieux tries to present itself as, they're for okay immigrants, they're for immigrants that go through the right channels and so forth, in reality, they have links to far-right racists, and they themselves are a far-right group. So they call this demonstration, and it was a show of confidence. And like I said, they're a group that needs to be taken seriously. They're very unique to Quebec in terms of their appeal to, Quebec nationalism and to some things that are unique to the Quebec political environment, but some things that are kind of universal to people who are confronting fascism and the far-right are their focus on migrants and their obsession with Islam. And they try to demonstrate here in Montreal. Montreal, as opposed to the rest of Quebec, is sort of seen as a bastion of anti-racism. It's a city similar to a lot of other metropolises all over the U.S. That has a lot of immigrants. It's a city about 30 to 35% visible minority. It's a city where they haven't been very successful. So for them to call this demonstration and to say beforehand, their leader said that this is going to be our best demonstration ever. Oh. It showed a strong confidence. And the way they organized too, because they held back on naming where they would demonstrate. They have a hierarchical structure. They're organized in clans, sort of playing off this wolf pack idea. They divide their clans into different Quebec regions. So Montreal is Clan 6. So they have a former, they align themselves with a former leader of the Ku Klux Klan. They're divided up into clans, but as I joked during the demonstration, the only clan that I'm into is the Wu-Tang Clan, and we should have played that music against them. But in any case, because of that hierarchical structure, that quasi-military structure, they're able to hold back on, naming where they're going to be until the very last minute.
Right. This seems to be something that's happening a lot in the U.S. too, and this seems to be kind of where the far right is really going, where they're kind of denouncing outright white nationalism, neo-Nazism, but at the same time they're still building a very large tent which encompasses all those various groups because they need the muscle. I mean, we saw this in Portland on the same day that you all were out in where you were at. I'm just curious, what has changed in the far right just in terms of strategy or repositioning of different groups since the main Daily Stormer guy was doxxed and that all happened. Has anything changed at all, or is it the same?
Well, the Zeiger, whose real name is Gabriel Soyer-Chaput, he sort of disappeared.
Right.
There was an interview with him where he was essentially crying about what had happened. But there's a disjunct between, of course, the Daily Stormer, which is this sort of online presence, the biggest online neo-Nazi presence, appealing to youth and what have you, and people like Zeiger being sort of the intellectuals of the movement and the day-to-day stuff. So, there are people who are in Daily Stormer book clubs and what have you, but a group like La Meute, we should take those neo-Nazis seriously and those open Nazis seriously. And back in May, there was a demonstration that went straight to Zeiger's house here in Montreal. And also, and it happened to be on the same street, for fuck's sake, we went to a key member of a group called the Soldiers of Odin, which is a neo-Nazi group that's aligned themselves more and more with a Quebec City-based neo-Nazi group called Atalante, which, you know, which is out and out Nazi. So, you know, they've been doxxed, they've been confronted, they're being dealt with. But a group like La Meute has pretensions for bigger support. I think, you know, their models, I mean, when they put out a promotional video before their demonstration here in Montreal on July 1st, their video had scenes of Quebec and what have you, but then also had scenes from Europe of far-right demonstrations in Italy, in Poland, in Hungary, in Austria. You could capture the faces of figures like Martin Sellner from Generation Identity in Austria, right, or the current Interior Minister Salvini in Italy. So, you know, sort of a bit of distance from the out-and-out neo-Nazis, but having enough of a big tent so a lot of those people infiltrate, but also gaining a certain momentum. So that's why what happened yesterday, July 1st, was so important, because if they were able to demonstrate openly with very little opposition, that would have given them an incredible boost in terms of their bigger strategy. But what ended up happening was that they weren't able to demonstrate, and their so-called best, what was going to be their best demonstration ever, was a total failure.
Yeah, and they did not march. Did clashes break out? It looked like the police had it pretty well separated, but they for sure did not march at all.
They didn't march at all. What happened was they decided to meet at a location near a metro station in downtown Montreal, which is in front of the immigration building. That wasn't known until Saturday night, and the demonstration was Sunday afternoon. So anti-fascists and anti-racists still met at where we were planning to meet, and then got on buses, cars, the metro, to get to their location before they were going to start. And we had them pinned in on both sides, and of course the riot cops were there. And they were basically, and there's a heat wave going on right now in Montreal, so they were basically baking in the sun, using industrial quantities of sunscreen, while we were giving them a soundtrack of slogans that were welcoming refugees and Muslims and migrants. They were not able to march. They wanted to. That was part of their plan. They made that clear. They were simply held on that block. At one point, some of their security officials were trying to get out of their being pinned in. From what I hear from screenshots of their internal correspondence afterwards, they had forgotten their water in a car. So that's a pretty big deal, because it was a hot day. You needed to be drinking water literally every 30 minutes. Otherwise, you're going to dehydrate. So they were suffering and hiding out in the shade where there was shade. But when those security officials, and just to sort of give you an idea of what this group is like, their head of security is a guy by the name of Jacques Gagné, who's a former cop for the Quebec City Police. So that gives you an idea of you know, their reach. This person used to work for the cops and now is their head of security. As he was getting near the riot cop line and giving indication that they were trying to get through and be tough, you know, they were shut down. There was a well-timed smoke grenade thrown in. There were well-aimed projectiles thrown in, and they retreated, and they never tried to march again. One of their buses that had bussed some of their members in was attacked. From what I know, some comrades were arrested, but I don't have the details yet about whether they're charged or whether they're still detained. The members from one of their clans, Clan Number 2, which comes from the Saguenay region, which is several hours away, they left their list of who was on their bus, so their members are basically, you know, on the verge of being docked. So it's a huge failure for them. And you know, generally these things are satisfying, and you know, for anti-racist, and you know, it's good to have those successes. I do have need to say though that, you know, in the long term there are significant challenges in dealing with the far right. But what makes their failure worse is that they bragged that it was going to be their biggest success. They right. had this illusion somehow that maybe anti-fascist on July 1st, a holiday, would go away or wouldn't be there or wouldn't care. And, you know, our number should have been larger. We were several hundred, but we should have been a lot larger. We need to have thousands in a city like Montreal come out each and every time. And that's part of the challenge of convincing broader segments of social movements and of the left and of progressives that, you know, you need to get out there and confront these folks using whatever means people are comfortable with. But still, the fact that they brag that this would be their greatest demo makes this a total failure for them.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, and it was kind of a similar situation in Portland, although there was violence, you know, pretty intense violence. You know, they didn't have their march and they went back on their buses. And by the end of the day in Portland, they were saying stuff like, you know, the police had betrayed us, even though the Department of Homeland Security was out there, you know, basically marshaling their event and shooting people with pepper balls and such like that. But I'm curious your thoughts. I mean, very similar situation in Portland where it was like hundreds of people that came out, you know, larger on the anti-fascist and anti-racist side. But, you know, what are your thoughts on, you know, making those hundreds grow into thousands? Because, again, if there's much more people there, it's just it's so much more demoralizing for them. And they know that really they, you know, they can't do this type of organizing. So how do we kind of, you know, get those numbers, especially as Charlottesville kind of grows farther and farther into the distance? And also these groups try to kind of distance themselves from, you know, outright neo-Nazism.
Well, that's the key strategic question that a lot of us have been reckoning with for the last 2, 3, 4 years, but definitely in the last 18 months. And, you know, one thing that will get people out is when horrible things happen, but we can't wait for horrible things to happen. We don't want those fucking horrible things to happen, like when Heather Herr was killed or people get murdered.
Right.
So when those happen, people react. But short of that, what I see as some of the challenges is that some people still don't take the threat seriously. They see it as something minor because, because they can ignore it, that people are relatively comfortable or they're dealing with other parts of movement building, what have you. So the fact that, you know, the basic premise of anti-fascism, which is that, you know, you get them at the roots. You don't let them get big. Even if they're 3 or 4, you confront them. That basis of anti-fascism isn't the basis of broader social movements, right? Those broader social movements, we'll take them seriously when they're marching in larger numbers or when something bad happens. So, that kind of popular education needs to happen more and more, and it's catching on that, you know, you can't wait for this to happen. And when people see what's happening in Europe, especially in the Western countries of Europe, like Italy and the potential of the Front National in France of getting power in several years, that might push people. One challenge that comes up a lot is the tactics, people's fear of being in confrontational situations and what that means. I'm a person of color, of South Asian background, and I know talking to a lot of my comrades, you know, just putting yourself in settings where people are expressing pretty vile racism. You know, like, just speaking for myself, like, there's a meme going out by these far right people, like, basically comparing me to shit, you know, and there's something racialized something racist in the way that comparison is made when you're black or when you're brown, right? And I haven't heard that since literally I was in elementary school, and that was like for 2 seconds before it was shut down, right? And that kind of stuff gets to you. It's like, why would I want to expose myself to that? And it sort of takes support amongst each other to say, look, we're going to put ourselves in these situations where these folks are saying vile things against trans folk, against queers, against Jews, against Muslim people, against black folks, against racialized folks. It's not something easy to get out to. So beyond the popular education, it's creating that support. It's creating that confrontation and creating that confidence together. So there are moments when we feel that. There are moments when it feels more depressing. But I have no major insight except that it's in the struggle, right? It's in doing it that we determine that. So I go back here in Montreal to a great moment. This was pre-Trump when a group called Pegida was trying to demonstrate. And we had a 700-800 person demonstration. And I'm trying to think to myself, what was in the mix there that brought that together? And certainly the participation of the student movement was part of it, because we were still in the afterglow of the student strike and the fact that large groups of students in colleges and universities were mobilized. There was a focus on confronting Islamophobia and what have you. And there wasn't the fear of going into it and feeling like you might get beat up or have a whole bunch of racist insults hurled at you. So there's a lot to think about there, but those are some of the challenges that I see. And unfortunately, if things get worse, that does push certain parts of the movement to take that more seriously. But we can't wait for that crap. And that's why anti-fascism is is often inherently unpopular. It's going to be something where hundreds of us, sometimes dozens of us, are doing it because we need to do it and sort of maintain that space. And that'll build when others sort of come around.
Right. You know, just in closing, one last question. I mean, I feel like a lot of these movements feed off of, you know, widely held misconceptions and lies and racist tropes about migrants, immigrants, people of color. In Canada, you know, what are some of the talking points that kind of allow these groups to kind of gain a foothold in? Because in the United States, it used to be that they're going to take your jobs, and I think more and more that is just kind of, you know, they're using that less, and now it's like, oh, MS-13 is going to come into your house and kill your whole family. You know, just kind of these grandiose, you know, totally removed from reality kind of visions of where violence is coming from in society. I'm just curious if any insights on, like, how the far right kind of breeds and feeds off of those misconceptions and how organizers can kind of combat those.
Well, a lot of it is, you know, what you just described, big lie politics, you know, like this idea that somehow we're on the verge of Sharia law. You know, it just starts up like there's going to be a mass influx of MS-13 and they're going to start stealing girls from people's homes. It's just absurd. Like after this demonstration, there were photos posted of people who were beaten up, and they were saying they were indigenous, and they were saying they were beaten up by me personally, and people affiliated with me. And it turned out, it's been quickly revealed, that those are fake photos. They're photos from other people beaten up in other countries, like in Denmark.
Oh, my gosh.
But, you know, a lot of this trolling online culture is about big lie stuff. And so where they're in the realm of possibility is where you have more mainstream politicians playing dog whistle politics with some of this far right stuff, right? And that goes around radical Islam. That goes around people who aren't fitting in with our culture. In Quebec, that's particularly resonant because there's sort of the double whammy of Francophone Quebecers, the majority here, fighting for their self-determination. And a lot of that is, you know, I'm an anti-nationalist, but a lot of that isn't inherently regressive. You know, it's progressive,
right?
like some of it can be, like in Catalonia or in Scotland or whatever. But a lot of that is regressive and plays into that idea that your culture is threatened. And that's the trope. But a big trope right now is just attacking Justin Trudeau and other politicians of his ilk here in Canada for being too pro-refugee, which is hilarious because in reality, this guy, Trudeau, plays, you know, wedge politics and triangulation, like classic Bill Clinton tactics, to sort of give the impression of being progressive while at the same time doing everything he can to make sure migrants can't get in. Like, they haven't canceled the Safe Third Country Agreement. That's why migrants are coming in irregularly, as they should. And I encourage them to continue to come. They're at visa at consulates and at embassies. People in Africa or Latin America prevented from coming here. So part of the sort of trope that makes sense, that's not a big lie, is saying that this guy is pro-refugee when he isn't. But compared to Trump, he is, right? I mean,
right.
That's what's being played out. But to be fair, the so-called Overton window, as the alt-right calls it, you know, like, that's shifted. That's what's disturbing. The fact that, you know, we're in a political context where politicians can get away from calling African countries shithole countries or calling Mexicans rapists or calling El Salvadorans. I think Trump recently called them dogs or something. That's just stunning that's the new shift in political discourse, and that a similar shift has happened here in Quebec and in Canada. But I don't want to overstate it either. Progressive movements are strong, but the anti-fascist, anti-racist element of that has to manifest itself more and more clearly so that we can shut this down where we're at.
On the same day in Portland, Oregon, far-right candidate for Senate in a different state, Joey Gibson, returned to Portland, where in early June he and his cronies in Patriot Prayer and the Proud Boys had been literally driven out of the city by large crowds of counter-demonstrators. Soon after, Patriot Prayer had another weak showing at a protest outside of a Planned Parenthood. And weeks later, Patriot Prayer members were found beating random people on the street. In response, Gibson pushed for far-right, Patriot, and Proud Boy groups to converge in Portland from across the country, even going so far as to pay for school buses to bring people to the location.
location, Joey had also chosen to rally in a federal park, allowing him protection from DHS agents. Despite all of this, Patriot Prayer brought out less numbers than those that came out from the surrounding local area to confront them. Moreover, even though the DHS did their best to protect them, they still were not able to march and quickly found themselves back on the bus headed home. In the end, the far right found themselves blaming the same police that had stood up for them and had their back the entire time. Gibson was hoping for a crushing victory to amass a huge amount of fighters from across the country in one place in order to smash Antifa off the streets and demoralize them, much like the plan for Unite the Right in Charlottesville. Instead, anti-fascists walked away from a hard-won victory of stopping the fascist march as the media ran a variety of articles noting the rampant violence coming from Patriot Prayer, their connections to neo-Nazis, and the protection they received at the hands of the Department of Homeland Security. Wanting to know more about what all went down in Portland, we were able to catch up and speak to anti-fascist author Shane Burley, who covered the demonstrations that day. All right, welcome back to the program, Shane Burley. Shane was out on the streets in Portland reporting on what all happened this weekend. It was pretty intense, very violent clashes between Patriot Prayer and anti-fascist and anti-racist counter-demonstrators. So Shane, just kind of give us a basic breakdown of just like numbers and, you know, kind of set the stage for us of what happened.
Sure. So Patriot Prayer, this far-right group, out here in Portland, has been mobilizing for the last like year and a half, 2 years. And they've been doing these sort of like, on the one hand, kind of Trumpian populist events, but also bring out a lot of white supremacists, white nationalist groups. They had an event about a month ago that was pushed back very heavily from anti-fascist protesters, community organizations, and things like that in town. And they didn't really get to complete their march that they wanted. And so they had kind of scheduled this second march about 30 days later to try and do that and say like they were, you know, weren't going to stand down against tyranny or something like that. And what they effectively did was they got a permit for a federal park, which gives them DHS protection. And they brought in Proud Boys from a whole number of states. Jason Wilson of The Guardian reported it as at least 60 Proud Boys. I might go a little higher and say maybe more like 80. But it was from multiple states and multiple crews of Proud Boys. That was the dominant faction of people that were there. It was half the speeches that were given. So they did like a few speeches, a lot of kind of strange stuff about, I don't know, Luciferian Marxists and people controlling banks and stuff like that, and a lot of support for Tommy Robinson, the guy who founded the English Defense League, who's in prison now on hate charges. Mm-hmm. So basically shortly thereafter, they're getting ready for their march. Basically in mass, they started suiting up with body armor and other things and then charged the streets. And basically it seemed to me that the police completely stood down, let them turn a corner, and just like charge at counter demonstrators and just start attacking people. And when I say attacking, I mean gang beating people on the ground, putting people in the hospital, beating them with pipes and other things. Eventually they got pushed back. They got labeled a riot by the police department, and they weren't really able to continue. They kept getting like people pushing back and splitting up their march as they tried to continue. So they ended up getting basically escorted back to the park. So they didn't actually end up getting to do their march again because of the large counter demonstration that happened.
Now, I mean, the police took weapons, we read, from the anti-fascist side. Did they do that on the Proud Boys side or the Patriot Prayer side?
To a degree, they're not allowed to bring weapons into the park. It's the federal park and there's federal like weapons restrictions, but they did basically have like a lot of flagpoles and things like that, which were not taken. And a lot of them were wearing body armor, things like metal plates that they were using as weapons. Frankly, they were doing like what appeared to me to be like squad attacks, like you would have seen from like neo-Nazi skinheads, of like, you know, like rushing individuals, gang beating them, and then moving to the next person. And there seemed to be a complete stand down from police around that. They were shooting in flashbangs and pepper balls. I got hit with a lot of pepper spray and got a chemical burn on my arm, but they really were not going after the Proud Boy side very much at all. It was, I guess, in a way perplexing because of how tolerant they seemed to be letting Proud Boys through.
And what was the role of the DHS in all of this? I mean, we read reports that they essentially, like, let the Proud Boys come up to their line and then like allow them to go through to attack anti-fascists. But then also at one point they were, you know, shooting pepper balls at anti-fascists, like basically as the clashes broke out. So, you know, both sides start fighting and they basically turn on one side and attack them.
That's what it seemed to be. I mean, DHS was spread a little thin around there because they're also supposed to be covering part of the ICE encampment, the Occupy ICE PDX encampment. So there wasn't as big of a presence of DHS, but they were there. They were kind of tasked with supporting a rally in the federal park. But again, I mean, all law enforcement involved seemed to stand down and then obviously push back heavily on counter protesters. There was a lot of pepper balls fired at counter protesters. A local reporter had been in a Starbucks near where that clash ended up happening, which is right near the park shortly there before it started, and heard police officers saying, like, hey, let's just let them fight. Right. Like, we're tired of this. There's at least a perception, I think, going around that was allowed to happen, and that essentially provided the Proud Boys a certain amount of cover.
Now, let's talk a little bit about, because in the last couple months, you know, the last big clash that happened, there were fights, but then Patriot Prayer kind of went on a march and they were basically, you know, pushed out of the city by anti-fascists who followed them. The Proud Boys and Patriot Prayer's numbers kind of dwindled. And then after that, Joey Gibson had another event outside of Planned Parenthood that was, you know, very sparsely attended. So, I mean, it seemed like their numbers were going down. And then at this demonstration, they pulled from people across the country and especially across like the West Coast, where they have like more contacts, whether in the Bay Area or down in Southern California. Why do you think they did this? Do you think this represents kind of like is this a turn in strategy, or they just felt like after kind of a various defeats that they needed to kind of have a strong showing? And what does this say for kind of what's to come?
I mean, I think that's right. I think they saw a series of defeats and wanted to have a good showing. It's all very based on some kind of like toxic idea that they need to stand their ground, quote unquote, right? And so, by focusing their constituency on Proud Boys, who are just basically there to fight, it seems like, and that's what the rhetoric, both like in these local organizations and from Gavin and nationwide, that's what they're making this about. And so, yeah, they did have dwindling numbers in a lot of ways. They were able to supplement that by bringing in a lot of people. At one point, a school bus full of Proud Boys showed up from Washington and dropped people off. So, like, it's not like these are like local people in general. And so it seemed like they wanted to do whatever it took to basically push back. There's not a lot of rhetoric from them about politics other than fighting the left. And so everything about it just seemed about getting people there that were willing to fight and kind of do like brutal street action.
Right. And even then they didn't have enough numbers. I mean, this was even said supposedly on some of the live streams, they did not have enough numbers to counter people that were largely from the surrounding area.
And they never have. Their numbers are always dwarfed by counter protesters from organizations, anti-fascist organizations, community groups, and so on. There was also a large contingent of labor unions and like some, I think, primarily rank and file unionists, especially from trade unions that had come out. This new group or coalition called Labor Against Fascism that brought out a lot of people. So there was just like a lot of people that were organized around them. And there's never been a situation when they weren't outnumbered like multiple times over.
What do you think the ramifications in Portland will be for this event? I mean, it seems like a turning point, but also just because the nation itself is so crazy that, you know, I feel like this event might get lost in the sauce. But I mean, do you think either that people in Portland and the surrounding area will pause to think about what it means for DHS agents on the streets to be basically acting as a auxiliary force for, you know, a far right street movement, and also just the amount of violence that the Proud Boys dished out? I mean, do you think that, you know, on top of like a couple weeks ago, I mean, literally like Tiny and some of his friends were riding around in trucks, in a truck, and, you know, beating up random people on the street. I mean, are people in Portland just going to get tired of this? And like the next time that these people come out, we'll see more, or will this have an effect where it will scare people off the streets?
I'm not entirely sure. I mean, their violence is increasing. It increased last time. It increased this time. I only expect it to further increase. I mean, these, like, the Proud Boys are going to fucking kill somebody. Like, that's what they were out for. I mean, there was times, if it wasn't for anti-fascist protesters, and even some reporters, they would have murdered people on Saturday without question. So, like, they're absolutely escalating that kind of violence, and it really terrorizes the community. I think, in general, what happens with, like, a reasonably politicized community in the area of a lot of people who do organizing is that they kind of refuse to be intimidated and answer that fear with more counter-organizing, which I think is a much safer situation to be when you have large masses of people organizing together and supporting each other. I know there's a really big focus on protecting communities from the Proud Boys and keeping an eye on what their activities are day-to-day rather than just at these large events. So I think it has the capacity to mobilize people a lot, and it needs to, because they're incredibly dangerous, and without, you know, people doing an organized opposition to that, they are really, really going to hurt somebody. I think with DHS, there's an entire societal shift about how people are viewing DHS. I mean, there's things like this, which I think are really black and white. And then there's also stuff like basically their tacit support of ICE and victimizing deportations. And so I think all across this area, at least, DHS is starting to be seen with a lot less positive light.
You know, just one last question. I mean, you know, hearing you say that, you know, the Proud Boys are going to kill somebody, I mean, that's very ominous, but I feel like most people that listen to this will not disagree with that assessment. What type of organizing do you think needs to happen in order to, you know, either, you know, counter-organize against them, or, you know, when they come out the next time, show up in mass numbers so they just can't even move?
Yeah, I mean, I think it needs mass numbers so they can't even move. I mean, I think the safest thing that people can do is come together. And that's when you see, like, really large successful actions against white supremacists in the area. It comes from a really large mass of people that stops their tracks, actually stops their ability to come in and just start attacking people. Because what they do is try and break people off from the crowd and seriously attack them and seriously hurt them before they're able to do whatever. And so a large mass of people and coming together is really, I think, what stops them. And if we see, like, larger and larger numbers coming out to stop them, like we did a year ago, when Patriot Prayer had an action after one of their followers murdered a couple of people on a train in Islamophobic rage, about 4,000 people came out then. If we can start seeing those sorts of numbers, I think that's frankly the largest thing that will shut down the Proud Boys' growth and their ability to enact violence. And I also think a lot of anti-fascist organizations in the area have been really committed to doing that and protecting people and keeping people safe in those situations and making that a priority. And so I think going forward, it really should be that we're able to communicate with other people about the value of supporting large protest actions that will stop their growth and their ability to victimize people.
Right, because, I mean, as you said on Twitter, you know, it does seem that Joey Gibson will try to do this again soon, mm-hmm. and he's just, I mean, there seems to be no question at this point. I mean, he has no hope for, you know, winning an election or kind of pandering to, like, you know, politics as usual or staying away from street marches. I mean, this is what he does, and he's just going to continue to ride this, you know, minimal wave of celebrity until the wheels fall off.
I mean, it's all he has left, you know. But I think the positive thing I can say about Saturday was a lot of people taking care of other people, seeing people hurt and finding ways of supporting them, getting people out of dangerous attack situations and stuff. And I think that's always what we should be looking at, because without that community support, without those organizations, without the people doing that, people would have died on Saturday.
Right. And also they stopped the march. I mean, they did not march. And
yeah.
And I mean, I think the other thing, I don't know if you want to comment on this, but, you know, at the end of their march, Patriot Prayer had turned their, you know, their rhetoric had become the police sold us out, or, you know, the police betrayed us, you know, which is so silly, because, I mean, you know, they're surrounded by DHS agents. I mean, the police are totally protecting them, but I don't know. I mean,
right. I think it's any time they're not allowed to win, they blame whatever institutions are around them.
Right.
So, like, I mean, they've never been able to get a size enough to be able to, like, actually try and occupy the streets of Portland, of which no one wants them there. I mean, when they're on the streets, people come out of bars, like, yell at them. No one wants them around. And so, like, they're never able to get enough traction to really do whatever the vision they have of their growth.
And you think that vision is something, like, akin to, like, the riots that took place for Tommy Robinson in the UK?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, they would not stop talking about Tommy Robinson. I mean, I think that's the image they have for themselves in a lot of ways is comparable to the EDL in Europe.
Right. Well, Shane, thanks so much for joining us and sharing your insights on this. And I mean, as frightening as the violence was, I mean, it's also inspiring to see people fighting back and standing up for themselves and just staying strong, you know, no matter what the odds.
That's going to do it for us tonight. Until next time, we'll see you soon. This has been the It's Going Down podcast. Check itsgoingdown.org for daily updates, columns, action reports, and news. Go to itsgoingdown.org/shop to support us and follow us on all social media platforms. IGD, your daily resource for insurgent proletarian life.